After this episode, after the track was built, they wanted the radio at the corner, so I went out with Transit and tried the best of my ability to get the radio and put it down on paper. And they sent down a team, and we did what I did and went back, and with their calculations, they said that never would anybody beat 1 minute mile, 1 minute on that mile and a half track. And since then, they're down to 45 seconds or something horrible. So, the opening day of the racetrack, of course, is April 27, 1957. Bill Barnett started the first race. We had Dr. Noble and Dr. DeBall for track positions for that race. We had free passes for any nurse and chair in the hospital that wanted them. And it was quite a grand opening, a beautiful day. At that, for the opening race, the only spectator here was the outfield on 112. And Bill Kimberly would have a race team there, and Kimberly Clark. After the race, Bill came up to me and said, "Jim, you sell your share of the track here for $150,000. I said, "Bill, you're crazy. Look at that crowd. It's beautiful. I just wouldn't sell for anything." I should have sold it to him. But that was when sports car racing was fun. Briggs Cunningham was there with his two or three trailers full of cars. And the Maserati team, the Ferrari team, with their complement of blonde, beautiful, shapely pit crews. And it was none of the high-pressure racing that is now. It was almost after you got stoned type thing into the corner. But now they won't shoot anybody or run them over or do anything.
How much opposition was there in town to the track?
Well, there was no... We ran a town vote after that town meeting to see, you know, what the feeling was. And the complete town voted on it. And the pro-track people beat them, anti-track 2-1. Whether that representative, I don't know. But after it was built and running, the Landmark Protective Association was financed by here, assuming it was for tilt. The active organization was, of course, Landmark Protective Association. It was, should I put it, energized by Herb Birdball Sr. He was a spokesman for the group and I'd call it rabble-rousing. And through the efforts of the Limerick Protective Association, I spent most of my time, it seems, in lawsuit cases in Litchfield. The sheriff and I became close friends, him serving summonses on me.
For what?
Oh, noise? So they would pick up any instance to sue them, anything. Primarily, you know, it was a big, long lawsuit when they tried to close the track down. And they did have it curtailed quite a lot, but good Judge Shea was against anything. And, you know, the thing that is that most of the people that were against the track didn't live in Limerick. The people that lived in Limerick were all in favor of it. They testified for it en masse during the trial. And what really amuses me now is the people that move into this area just recently, knowing full well the track is there, they're the ones that scream the loudest about the noise of the track. And I cannot understand the thinking of people like that.
That's ridiculous.
It certainly is.
I mean, it's there for all to see. We all know it's there.
You should. If you don't, I think it's your fault.
And you sold out, did you not?
More or less, I sold out because I mainly got sick of being hassled so much. and one of our local residents also instituted a minority stockholder suit, and he wouldn't even have been in the stock as a stockholder unless I arranged for him to get the stock. I wanted him to be a director because he was knowledgeable in racing, and I didn't know anything in racing. And at that time, you couldn't be a director unless you were a stockholder. So I engineered and sailed stock to this gentleman. And he had the delusion of grandeur, or whatever you want to call it, against the minority stockholder suit to try to kick me out. He lost. But then, after that, there was another after that, instance was, but Jim Haynes came into the picture, occupied all the stockholders. So at that time I sold.
And you're glad you're out of it?
Yes, I think I am. It was quite an education, of course. I, especially in human nature, I've learned an awful lot about that.
Do you go to the races?
Very seldom. Mainly, I think, because it's a different racing, type of racing than what I knew. And also, most of the people that I knew during that period of time have either died or moved away or retired or stopped coming. So I guess I'm glad I'm not running it anymore. To get back to the farm living, in my childhood, I'd say about age of 5 to 10 or 12, we had town water, but no active bathroom outside of the sink and bathtub. There was no toilet in the house. There was a chemical toilet that was emptied once a day, and outside of that there was a bath house that was activated daily, during daylight hours, I should say. And as a child, I remember the wood stove in the kitchen, a big kitchen range, my mother, and various relatives doing a lot of canning during the summer. We grew our own vegetables, our own pigs, of course our own chickens and eggs, milk, butter, beef, occasional turkey or two. Cure our own meat, salt pork, sausage, bacon, hams. And of course, my mother used to preserve all the vegetables. It was almost a self-sufficient operation. In the fall, my father used to buy a barrel of flour, a barrel of sugar, a barrel of salt, huge cartons of salt codfish, and I would guess about 20-pound cardboard boxes of Unita biscuit milk crackers that are still made in the best one still. My mother made a lot of dishes out of milk crackers.
Like what?
Scalloped oysters. Of course, crackers and milk and cheese is
the best
staple. And scalloped tomatoes, milk crackers, corn and sausage. You ground the sausage patties, make the gravy, put a layer of sausage and corn in, a layer of crumpled up milk crackers, and build up the casserole layer after layer. Pour the sausage gravy in and fill it all up with milk and bacon.
It's fattening. Delicious.
Greasy and cholesterol and everything. Yeah. Mm.
And there was dried beef up in the attic. And the word chip beef came by it naturally because this was to be petrified. You couldn't slice it. You chipped off little chips. And that was recasted a little bit in the frying. And you had to soak it to get some of the salt out of that, of course, reconstituted it. And chip beef and gravy on toast and mashed potatoes was another frequent meal. mainly it was what we grew and raised on the farm. Once in a while, we used to be fish peddlers, and we used to come along with either wagons or a Model T truck with boxes full of fish with ice all over them. Once in a while, my mother used to buy them on the
Do you have brothers and sisters?
I have a brother, Dick, who's now in Oklahoma. My sister, of course, lives here. I have a son and daughter. My son lives in Pittsburgh, working for Westinghouse. My daughter is in Long Island. She's married to an anesthesiologist. She has four children. My son has three. The oldest son, my daughter, is now going to medical school. It doesn't seem possible. going back to the farm.
Do.
As a child, my basic chores when I was, say, 6 to 12, was feeding the chickens, filling the wood box, seemed to be a continuous job. And when I was a little older, carrying the milk pails from the guys who were milking the cows out to the milk house. And during the summer, I used to drive the hay wagon while they loaded hay. Oh, just prior to that, I mean earlier than that, as I mentioned before, all the machinery was forced gone. The mowing machines, of course, was Forrest John Moore. The hay was raked with a Forrest John dump rake that gathered up the rake in these tines, the hay in the tines, and then dumped it when it got full. And then guys would go along and pile it up into cocks. They'd pile it towards the center and just into a hay cock. And then after cured a day or so, along with a hay wagon, and two or three men would take a pitchfork and go down to the hay cock and throw it onto the wagon. Another man was placing it on the wagon so it didn't fall off. And one of my jobs when I was older was driving the horses from that house. For a while, the same period of time, when I was 5 or 6, I was out playing in the hay field. And I thought it would be great fun to ride under one of these haycocks. My father came along with a pitchfork and put it through the haycock and threw me.
Oh.
And threw my lung and my shoulder, and the third time missing. He carried me from the hayfield. At that time he had an Overland car. And he drove to Sharon Hospital. And at the rate of speed, burned the bearings out. So the poor fellow got out of the car with me unconscious, and some fellow came along and gave him a ride to the hospital. It was John Carley from Sharon.
Oh,
Don Carley's
father.
Carley.
Mm-hmm.
And I was in the hospital, and they tell me I died at one period of time one night. And there was a nurse on 24-hour duty there, and she quickly pumped some adrenaline in my heart and got it going. Of course, I don't remember much about that. I do remember the wound being cauterized by putting a probe, wire probe, with a iodine-soaked swab through my chest. That brought me conscious. And while I was recuperating, I remember Bill Barnett sitting down a little glass ball, snowflake ball, turning up the snowflakes that fall down.
Mm-hmm.
5 or 6. I also broke my arm when I was about 7, jumping off the back end of the Model T Ford and catching my arm and into tailgate. In the hospital, I fell out of bed and I didn't dare reset the elbow, so it's slightly crooked. He went to, as I was saying, he went to school the first 3 grades, but same as all of us. I remember one time, on some occasion, my father gave me 50 cents to put in the bank. When I started going as far as the bank, top of Holly Street at the time, I had to go by the Jigger Shop, which was where the laundromat is. It was a candy ice cream place. Well, I went into the Jigger Shop and I spent 50 cents on penny candy. At that time, for 50 cents, you could buy a half a bushel, almost, of penny candy. I was the most popular kid in school. Unfortunately, Mrs. Ham was then on the Jigger Shop. She and Mr. Ham called my father and wanted to know if he knew that I was spending 50 cents on penny candy. He didn't know, but I found out he knew when I got home from school that day. It was one of the few times I got soundly spanked on the bottom.
Was that a lot of money to put in the bank, 50 cents? I mean, why would you do that?
I think it was, it was at that time.
That was worth putting in the bank.
Mm-hmm. I suppose it was by Institute of Sense of Saving and was there in the sun.
Where'd you go to school when you left there?
The fourth through sixth grade was down where the post office is now. It used to be the high school. And I left fourth and fifth grade there. I skipped the sixth grade. I am convinced that the reason I skipped was the fact the teacher couldn't stand me. So I went directly to the seventh grade. And Mrs. Miner, who has since died, she was Maude Hogan at the time, Bill Hogan's sister. Bill still lives in South Haven. She was a seventh grade teacher, and she was one strict teacher. We whispered or did anything out of hand. She had a ruler that was about 16 inches long. She'd come on a whop of kids right over the head with a ruler. At this day and age, she would be sued by a parent. And then the eighth grade was taught by Miss Taylor, who had to resign for having dates with two of the senior girls. Miss Crofton was freshman in high school. 7th and 8th grade in high school, board because of the school. Ms. Crofton was a teacher in the freshman class and homeroom teacher. Leon Bowman, who is Louise Solon's, or was Louise Solon's brother-in-law, taught algebra. He was homeroom teacher of the sophomore class. Carol Smith was one of the teachers of the junior class and taught dramatic table. And Mrs. Fitz, who was in Miss Gordon, a senior teacher, homeroom teacher, she taught history and social studies. He was a wonderful teacher. And Mr. Loring was principal. And Mr. Loring was a better character. He taught chemistry and physics. I understand he was shell-shocked or something, World War I, and periodically he'd have a relapse or something, but slightly off his rocker. I remember one time in chemistry class, he up ahead of the class and all said, "Now I want to show you how we went to football teams and when I was in college," and he crouched down and crashed through all the desks and chairs in the class. Right up to him. Anyway, I graduated in 1937. There were 21 graduating students in that class.
Then the war came pretty soon.
Well, that's pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
I got out of high school and at that time, or prior to that, my father had bought a milk route from the Peel family where Tilt lives now. And Lee and Milton did the business along with Paul Cleveland. It's Oakwood Farm with the Rose Hill Farm. And later on, they started up Wells Hill Dairy and which turned into Salisbury Farms, which was bought out by
Tollgate.
Losing track of where I am here.
It's all right.
I'm still in school. No, I just graduated.
Yes.
Oh, one time, I think I was about a sophomore in high school, when Salisbury High School was small and as unknown as it was, almost became state champs in basketball. They got beat 2 out of 3 games by Hillhouse and Hartford. Weaver.
Mm. Weaver High School.
Mm. And Wilbur Henry was a coach. And the team was the Whalen boys, the Buck, Rick, Dave Winner. Kelly boys, Kelly boys, Herbie Atkins, was the greatest basketball dribbler in the world. He could dribble under his legs and he looked like the Harlem Globetrotters. And Garwood Melter, Jr.
And you?
Oh, no. Mm. I was too young to wear basketball. Play basketball. But they almost won the state championship, and I think they got psyched out in the third game. Anyway, the whole town went to Hartford to watch that game as it was. One of the basketball games, they were playing Pine Plains, and there is a very crucial game, too, and being played in Pine Plains. And that was from Robert Sullivan down. That where it was the basketball game, but the whole town was on fire. I used to, of course, play baseball. I was growing up. We used to have impromptu games on the farm. In Hackford, right next to Roots, they just put a porch on the Alta Wire.
Oh, yes.
And that there used to be a impromptu baseball field. We used to play impromptu teams from Salisbury. There's great rivalry between the towns, even with the Lakeville team in Salisbury, town teams. We used to play the Reggies, and we used to play the Wells Hill Reggies. And, let's see. Things are a lot easier in those days, it seems. I remember when we were decorating for the big junior prom, you need a lot of material for the decorations. And Jim Hines had the Blackman shop on Walton Street, he just built a gym. He had us take his truck to go around and collect all this material. None of us had licenses. I was about 15 or 14 at the time. Probably could drive now since we were moving on. And about the time I age from 12 on or earlier, used to buy Model T's for $5 a piece. And George Cleveland had an old Star car. And Bob Dufour had a Buick. Judd, I don't think he related to the Judds. I don't know if it was Bill Judd the Barber or what. He had an old 4-cylinder Buick touring car. And he used to run all over the farm with these cars, with our farm and Cleveland's farm. And at one time he used to go all over the town with them on back roads. We went up Mount Riga one time, my Model T, boiling all the way, got up to the water and shot half the hill. The only thing we could find to fill up the radio was a half pint whiskey bottle in the gutter there. I used to run these Model Ts until they dropped dead, something horrible happened to them. And I'd put them in the farm dock and go buy another one for $5. Wish I had them now. I bought a 1928 Model T, which is a pretty rare thing. Bar wheels, closed coupe with a back seat, little back seat, and I made the flower holders on the sides of the car. I got home immediately, I took the body off. Just put a seat across the frame, and that was my runabout. And John Martin was riding with me one time. John Nancy lived next door where nothing said. We went over there in the farm lot, which were Emerson's places. And there was a pile of this during the winter, there was a pile of hay at the foot of this hill. And I thought it'd be great sport to run up that hill, see the hay explode and fly. Unfortunately, the hay was frozen solid. The Model D hit it, and the front end went up in the air, and the hind end went up in the air. John Martin went up in the air, and when he came down, the Model D wasn't there. He rolled about 50 feet, it seems. And I cautiously went up to him to see if he was all right. I thought he was killed, at least. And he was just slightly groggy and got up and shook himself, and he's fine. And George and I used to run down through these woods with our cars. And one time Lee Dufour rode down with me to see, you know, what all his son was associating with. He got down to where our cabin was. We got out of the Model T for it. He said, "I'll never ride with you again." Lee was quite a guy. Remember he and Robert Storr. I think there was a clash of personality between those two men. They were just like two kids are fighting in the schoolyard. Now on Halloween, Lee Dufour was over his garage crossing Robert's hall, throwing rotten eggs at him. Robert standing in front of his store throwing potatoes or something at Lee Dufour. Dufour's garage is quite a hangout for all of us boys down there. There's a place to watch the world go by and to talk about various and some important things. Sometime a car go up front of Dufour's garage. A very self-important, newly rich fellow with a big cigar in his mouth, riding a big Cadillac. And rolled his window down. "Hey, Mac, I'm going to New York." He looked up at him and says, "Go ahead." He was not unknown to be a little unscrupulous. His favorite check was somebody going to have their gas and oil checked and leave the pull the dipstick out. Wipe it off and carefully put it back in the motor, but not all the way down. Show it to the president, so you need a quart of oil. So I'll say, "Okay." So I move on, with a big pretense of putting a spout in an empty can coming out and pouring it into the motor. Bob will never forgive me if he hears this. Raving for a place with a town policeman. For a traffic. Think about it as well. His favorite trick when anybody came through town but was driving too fast, doing something wrong, he'd take the keys out of the car and walk out and start directing traffic again. And after an hour or so, the people would start getting a little irate. After maybe an hour and a half or 2 hours, we would give back the keys. Next time, no guy's so fast, so here you go, fast, get there quicker. It's very effective. Much easier than giving them a ticket. Let me see.
Now, we had a Dufour at Hotchkiss. He was the postmaster for years. Was he?
That was Ray Dufour.
Ray, it was Ray, wasn't it? Mm-hmm.
It was Ray, Les, and Lee.
And he lived in the building. He lived in, you know, it used to be the teen center or something. He lived upstairs.
I used to be the hub.
Mm-hmm, the hub.
Like the bigger shop.
Yes.
Ice cream, soda pop. Big marble counter and stools and fancy ice cream table with chairs. And Dufour and Pa Dufour. Lee's mother and father. They lived upstairs with Ray. Like between the garage and the pub was a little wedge-shaped building. It used to have a number of various little businesses in there. At the time, Billy Beers had a hunting, fishing tackle place there. Like he was the one who got me trout fishing when I was in the early teens. I mean, that really came. And after that, it was Bill Charman, a radio shopman. He then moved across the street from the basement part of the present apartment house of Tony Bryant. Campbell?
Yes.
Vern. Between Vern Campbell's place and the present local boot sale, which was the First National, which was about the store, in between that and Vern Campbell's used to be a building that housed the Lakeville Men's Club on the second floor. Card tables, pool tables, all the necessary paraphernalia. And on the first floor with a barber shop, Bill Judd's barber shop, where Paul Argo apprenticed, and another. It was a three-chair barber shop. Paul was man one and Mr. Judd man the other, until Paul had his own barber shop and what used to be the Western Union building, which is not the one. Remember, the Western Union building used to be a meat market. Which was Eggleston's meat market and then Redmond's meat market. So Redmond moved to where the apothecary shop is now. I bought a shotgun for a 10 gauge double barrel shotgun. It was about 14. And then still 10 gauge shotgun shells. My trouble is, at that age, every time I shot, it would knock me off my feet, so I sold it to someone. I think I traded to George Sherwood for another gun. Let's see. Oh, the Stuart Theater, of course, is in existence. The pizza house is now. And the EMP was underneath the building, before they moved down to where the AMP liquor store used to be. Next to the AMP store, which isn't there anymore, next where the gas station is now. And where the gas station is now used to be a park, where the band used to give concerts.
The Golf Station. The Golf Station, not the one was
Bud McCone and I played trumpet in the band at about the age of 10, I think. And it was given our job. Our job is to pass the hat for intermission for collections. The spectators. It's a practice, band practice, at the old firehouse that we were in. It was going on. We had band practice for the town offices now. Courthouse. It's a cabin. At the time, just a gathering place for town functions. Minor town functions. I used to go to swimming when I was allowed off my chores and on the farm. I used to envy the kids. kids in town, the townies, because they go to the lake all the time. I couldn't go except, you know, on rare occasions. After the lake, or a dreary Saturday afternoon, or the steward on the Stewart Theater used to let the kids in free of charge to clean up the theater after the movies. To see Tom Mix, Bobby Cassidy, before the silent movies came on. Piano player, left to the stage, creating music to suit the scene. During the Depression, I remember the square people to come to the theater, they used to have door prizes at the theater, sets of dishes and things like that. Oh, we used to go skating on the lake, and the lake used to freeze over more often than it does now.
What part did they set aside for ice?
The whole lake.
And you were skating on it?
Oh, you mean cutting ice?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, that was only later on in the winter when the ice got really thick. But we used to skate on it. Back doors and I used to drive our cars out there just in front of it. Slither and slide around. I was arrested, but I didn't go ever get it. Oh, and to skates get dull every now and then. So to get our skate sharp, we used to go to the old knife factory, and the caretaker, the overseer, the shutdown factory was Joe Carroll. And he'd sharpen the skates for all the skates. And to sharpen the skates, he'd go down and turn on the water turbine, and the whole factory would come to life. All the counter shafts, all three floors would start pouring, clanking, and
just to do away. Your skates?
Mm-hmm. I'd be absolutely amazed about it. I'd see everything turning just by turning one valve, and all those things started working. It's amazing for anybody 12 years older than me. Ernie Goddard and Louis Goddard had the Lakeville Market next to the Jigger Shop and the theater, which is now Charles Clover's place.
Mm-hmm. Bubbles and Bows.
And they had a Plymouth panel truck that used to deliver groceries to various customers. And Johnny Curtis worked for them. Father Johnny Curtis at the church. He used to live in the corner of the Loops offices upstairs. Henry Tallardy and Olive Tallardy were Dennis's. He's a plumber. The two big plumbing concerns here, Bonnie's and Harry Bell. Barry Miller used to be, well, later on he was something for Polyglot. Where the Boardman store used to be, which is one of the three department stores in town, used to have dry goods and various necessary stuff, the grocery store and the meat market. Liberty's drugstore was in. And the apartment still was very poor there at that time, too. And underneath, across from where the old bank building was, on Holly Street, Pete Everett's had a stationery store. And later, Hugo Cahill took that and went to Hugo Cahill. And next to the Holly Bob was the Lockman's meat market.
Is that Otama Lockman family? Uncle.
In the back of that was a beehive, which was the workers' living quarters for the knife factory. So there was a bunch of real cruddy apartments at the time. Yeah. four things. And then, of course, we're questioning such a knife factory that Billionaire was to forge with a knife factory. And when I was a kid, it was a Chinese laundry. And the Chinese were talking back and did laundry for people. And I'm sorry to say, us kids used to make life miserable for that poor China. That was Eaton story to begin with, and Eaton brought it up, and of course, the bill on it, that was funny done. But then, of course, it's been Franklin's story. Oh, you go for full alert for. Eaton by maps at the time, doing picture framing and all kinds of glass cutting and tape work. I think that's, well, that was the same period of time. When I was in second or third grade, my job was to, carry cocoa up to the boys. Every afternoon, or morning, I forgot which, but maybe it's for lunch. I have to go down to Mr. Bowles and two.